Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. Tonight, we're going to hear about some unusual theater. Some folks might say only in San Francisco theater. Russell Blackwood and David Bica are here to tell us about the Thrill Peddlers and the theater style called Grand Guignol, which dominates the troupe's currently running 16th annual Shocktoberfest. We'll also hear about some of the other Thrill Peddlers productions. Welcome, gents.
Thank you.
And before I get into the Thrill Peddlers, though, John Fisher of Theater Rhinoceros is here, a sort of a drive-by appearance, to tell us about his new production that opens this week called Shakespeare Goes to War, which sort of turns the thick house topsy-turvy. John is executive and artistic director of Theater Rhinoceros, the longest-running LGBT theater in the nation, and is an award-winning playwright. He plays his plays before Shakespeare Goes to War include The Joy of Gay Sex and Medea the Musical, which ran for 18 months in its original San Francisco co-production. John Fisher, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thanks, Eric. It's great to be here.
So what is Shakespeare Goes to War about?
Well, it's about sort of my obsession with Hogan's Heroes. When I was growing up, it was my favorite TV show. And then I found out what Nazis were really like, and I kind of cooled on it. But I still have this sort of thing stuck in my head about Colonel Klink and all that. So it's about this boy growing up in the 70s and his mentors, and one of them is his idea of Colonel Klink, and Colonel Klink can help him somehow. Of course he can't, but he thinks he might. And then he's also going through this whole thing about the Briggs Initiative from the 70s where they were going to fire queer teachers. So it's this kid's coming of age story in sort of this wacky kind of World War II overlay. And so Shakespeare Goes to War is how they put on plays in this prison camp in Germany to keep from getting bored during the war, which is true. They used to do that. I mean, you can find pictures online with these beautiful costumes, and they put on these productions and these plays.
I haven't thought about Stalag 13 in quite some time, but that was, it did seem kind of like a fun place to be in a
way. Oh, it seemed great.
Didn't it?
Yeah. It just seemed like, oh, it was all fun. It was so fun to be captured by the Germans and be in Nazi Germany. It's just ridiculous. So anyway, the serious side of it is about queerdom and how, you know, we make some progress and then people try and take things away from us. And I think that still goes on, not as much as in the 70s, but that was certainly my experience growing up in the 70s, watching sort of the ebb and flow of queer life.
Mm-hmm. So I hear that Shakespeare Goes to War is being staged in an unusual way. So tell us about that.
We've done a bunch of shows at Thick House, and if you've ever been to Thick House, you see that the audience has these incredibly steep risers that they sit on. So we put the stage on the risers, and we put the audience on the stage. So we flip-flopped it. And so you get this great mountain of theater in front of you. There's this huge mountain of stage that rises up all the way up to the ceiling. And that's how we use the set. And it's all played out as battle scenes and high school gymnasiums and things like that. So it's really quite fun. And it's a nice intimate space, but it's also a very exciting space the way we're using it.
So Thick House is over on Petrero, sort of the one side of Petrero Hill, sort of, right?
Yeah, it's right on Petrero Hill on 18th. Right at Carolina, between Carolina and Arkansas.
Wow. So the states neighborhoods. So is there as much seating on the stage as there is in the normal seating space?
You know, there's like 50 seats. It's nice that way. It's nice, you know, it's like one of those things. I'm really into theater that's either like really big or really small, you mm-hmm. know, really intimate or really huge. And this is definitely a nice intimate thing, which I think is a nice aspect of live theater. You can really see everything.
So why did you decide to do it in this fashion with the, I mean, you mentioned some, be able to do some theatrical stuff.
Every time I walk in there, I see like this really flat stage and then this really amazing audience area. And I was just like, why don't we just do it in the audience?
Just, damn it, I want to be there.
Yeah, I want to be, yeah.
Just the opposite.
Why does the audience get
to
have all the good views? Yeah. So, and it's been great working in there with that. And my designer, John Lau, has come up with a great set that sits on top of this area. So it's exciting. And, you know, I've always had this obsession with Shakespeare. I think he's like the lingua franca. He's the way we talk to each other. I think he created us in a way. And it's a way of talking to people. It's like music. It's something that we all share. I think Shakespeare amongst English speakers is, and so there's a lot of Shakespeare in it. Young people putting on Shakespeare, that first excitement of discovering Shakespeare and how you can use Shakespeare to make messages, statements about politics and your personal life.
So since you're we're recording this on Tuesday evening and you're dashing off to a dress rehearsal, which you just found out is actually having people coming to it.
Yes, there's an audience showing up tonight.
Listing.
Surprise.
Listing. So maybe you want to just do a little rehearsal for us right now. Is there a little section, a little part of some of your performance in it that you could
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. My anxiety is kicking in. Oh, my God. My performance anxiety. I'm not ready. I need my makeup. I need my water. I need my space. What can I do from the show? Ask me another question. Distract me. Something will pop
well,
in my head.
Okay, then.
Welcome to Stalag 4. I am Oberst Klambach. You will address me as Herr Oberst. That's all I can remember. Oh, my God. I can't believe I'm going in front of an
but
audience.
But you'll remember more tonight, I'm sure.
More will come back to me.
Because you won't be in a, you know, you won't be in a radio studio.
I'm the Colonel Crank. Yeah. Once I get in front of the prisoners.
And when you see the audience looking up at you from down on the stage, it'll all come back. Tell us a little bit more about Theater Rhinoceros's current status. For so many years, you had your own home theater on 16th Street near South Van Ness in the Mission. Now you use other venues, the Thick House, the Eureka Theater downtown.
Yeah.
That is on, I guess, did you call that the Financial District, Washington Street?
Yeah, it's Financial District, yeah, basically.
So how is it working to not have a fixed home and be kind of going around to these different venues?
It's great. I did about 10 years of directing at the old space on 16th Street, and I loved it. But it's really nice to have access to different spaces and to get to explore and to actually program spaces for plays and write plays for different spaces. So it's been terrific. It's lovely to move around and be itinerant. It's also nice to have a home, but I've done that, and I think that this is even more exciting, which is not to rule out the possibility of a home in future, but, you know, there's something so... Spaces, I walk into a space, it's like we're talking about that, how we're using this space. I walk into a space, I'm like, wow, this is great. We can do this with it, and this with it, this with it. And, you know, it's really been very exciting for us to be on the road. Every play is a completely different experience in all ways, not just the play itself. And that's very nice for us.
And I'm curious to maybe have all of you comment briefly, Mike. What is the, you know, sort of, there's this economic boom. Are theaters doing well now? Or are they struggling because all these arts organizations have rising costs and rents and all that stuff and being kicked out of their spaces? What's your perception of that?
I think the casting pool and the group of artists we're working with generally are having a harder time of it. Living in San Francisco.
Yeah, they have to commute farther. I mean, it's really hard to find, you know, the energetic young artist who can't afford to live near the theater where you're working.
And how about the theaters themselves? Are they having funding problems, or is it a little easier to raise funds now because you have, you know, some people with money? Maybe you have more patrons?
Well, it's funny. I mean, subscriptions are down. I mean, people don't really subscribe to theater anymore. They buy individual tickets. That's just the way people are now. They don't, you know, they don't make a big commitment. They make individual night commitments, and they're much more spontaneous.
You see it on Facebook 20 minutes before the show.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's amazing how people come to theater. We do well from sort of legacy donors, people who've been involved with the theater for a long time, leaving us money or giving us money. And it's kind of wonderful that way to receive support that represents a 35-year commitment to what you've been doing. I mean, it's really quite wonderful. And it kind of frees you up because you don't have to live off your box office all the time, which is nice. So for nonprofit theater, it's weird because it's scary because the money does seem to be going other places. And sometimes theaters seem almost always sort of under assault from developers. But for some reason, it hasn't quite happened. You know, it hasn't happened. Actually, new theaters are opening up in San Francisco. So I don't know. Do you feel besieged sometimes?
I do a bit, but our seats are full, and it's with a group of people who think the theater we're making is especially for them.
Yeah, when the shows actually happen, you're actually like, what are we worried about? I'm in a room full of people having a good time.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, whatever you read in the newspaper, it seems to work. Yeah. So it's more like a psychological burden at times.
Yeah, I definitely say in the case of the Hypnodrome, the audience is a very... they're very loyal and very that it's something that they've keyed into and they have a taste for it and there's a lot of people out there that are and it's just it's a unified group of people in a way that I don't know that might not go to see traditional theater other places, you know, they might not be as loyal to other theaters, but something at the Hypnodrome, I don't know if it's the wild factor or what that you know, really keys into a certain group of people that are.
And we're also a resident company, so they're recognizing many of the people who are on stage again. And we have two recurring festivals, a Grand Guignol Festival, which is Shocktoberfest, which is currently running, and then the Theater of the Ridiculous Revival, which we've been doing for 8 years now. And so that's a very specific theatrical genre slot in our season.
Right, right. And I would say in many ways Theater Rhinoceros and even New Conservatory, for not quite exactly the same reasons, but having this sort of dedicated core mission that
they're
fulfilling.
Yeah, we have people who've been coming to us for years, and they just, for some reason, they've latched on. We have a lot of recurring performers, too, and they keep seeing the same people over and over again, and they see me, and they know our board members. It's weird. I mean, I think queer theater is defined by family in San Francisco. It's not so much about the theater-going experience. It's about the community of artists and activists who created the queer community. And this is part of the ongoing legacy. Both these companies have been around for a long time. And the continuity means something to people. And I would never have thought that. Growing up, I would never have thought, you know, that I would be dedicated to a theater. I grew up on Broadway. For me, it was like individual show.
I promise I'll let you go because you got to dress rehearsal to go perform in.
I might have to perform John, with makeup on.
John Fisher, thanks very much for coming in. Tell us quickly when Shakespeare Goes to War
Shakespeare
runs.
Shakespeare Goes to War starts tomorrow night, Wednesday night, November 4th, and runs through the 28th at Thick House at 1695 18th Street at Carolina in San Francisco. And we perform Tuesday through Saturdays with matinees on Saturday afternoons. So we have 6 shows a week.
And where can people get the info?
www.therhino.org, therhino.org.
Thank you very much for being here, John.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me. Bye, Russ. Bye, Dave.
Bye, John.
Bye.
So, great to see you.
Now, the Thrill Peddlers, gents. You are listening to Out in the Bay, by the way. That was John Fisher of Theater Rhinoceros. And I'm also here with Russell Blackwood, founder and artistic director and director of the current production, Shocktoberfest, at the Thrill Peddlers, and David Bika, who plays in it and sings in it. And if you haven't had enough of Halloween, not enough blood and gore yet, then get your butts down to the Hypnodrome. So, Russell, welcome both of you. So I promised we'd play some music. Let's start with part of a song that you sing in, David. It's in Curse of the Cobra from Shocktoberfest, an evening of short plays now at the Hypnodrome Theater in San Francisco. Okay, so
that's a little Ema smack.
Is that you hitting that
the
high
last
note?
Bit? No, it's not me. That's my wonderful co-star Caroline Walker.
Okay, so that's David Bika singing most of that. The ritual, the Cobra ritual.
Yes, written by Scrumbly Coldwin. It's one of 5 pieces in this show. That five or four? Do we say five?
Five, because we have a blackout spook show.
Yeah,
finale.
The spook show. Yes, that's kind of melded into the whole evening of scares and shocks and Shocktoberfest.
So, yeah, what's the theme? What's the theme that holds together Shocktoberfest, Russell?
Well, I would say that there are themes that emerge as you see all these one-act plays. This is a bill that is more or less set in America, but it also has strong South Seas influences as well. The one place that we go that isn't in America is the imaginary Cobra Island, a resort island. And so I guess it's about mid-20th century America's and beyond's proclivity for orientalizing and exoticizing things South Seas and all the mystery that that brings along with it.
So what is what's going on in that song, the ritual song that we just heard part of you singing in, David?
Oh, wow. What is going on? There is a man who is looking for his lost friend, and he, while in his search, gets kidnapped by some snake people. And I, as Prince Cobra, am getting ready to give him his final goodbyes.
And the person he's looking for, the friend, is a kind of a puppy dog creature.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yes.
As a matter of fact, I think he's
a devoted boy puppy.
He's listed here as the puppy. It even says puppy.
Yes.
Maya Tamatayo. Is that French?
No, it's Polynesian.
Oh, it's Polynesian. What does that mean?
I'm not sure. We'd have to ask.
I don't know. There's a direct translation. It just means that.
Okay.
One of the things about the Grand Guignol is it's about variety. Yes. Mm-hmm. So the Grand Guignol started at a theater in Paris called the Théâtre du Grand Guignol, and you might see 5, 6, 7, 8 plays on the bill there. And the plays would vary between sex farces, comedy of manners, a melodrama, and then terror plays, which they became quite famous for.
Okay.
The terror plays were not so much about supernatural events as they were about the human monster,
mm-hmm.
That anybody next to you could be a madman, you know, waiting to sink his teeth into your throat.
We do see a few of them in this production.
Do indeed. So Shocktoberfest is our reimagining of Le Théâtre du Grand Guignol's bill of fare, and these are all wholly new pieces that use Grand Guignol as the springboard.
And where are they? When was that style of theater in its heyday?
The Grand Guignol ran from 1897 to 1962.
Okay.
And its heyday was the Belle Epoque in Paris and also heading into the 20s. World War II, I think, changed things for the Grand Guignol because suddenly these unspeakable things were now right in folks' backyard.
So I want to play a little bit of a dialogue from one of the other short plays in this set, and this is from this play called The Model House. Do we need anything to set this up? Let's see. This is like set in sort of 1950s or 1960s post-war suburbia. Is that fair to say, or is it sort of more like a desert scene?
1958.
Okay, 1958.
But it's kind of a Springfield as far as location goes. You know, mm-hmm. how Springfield and The Simpsons could be any place in America.
Okay, because I couldn't tell.
I would say this is similar.
From a toxic waste dump. And you're trying to, and David, you play the character of the Sarge who's come back, and he's trying to build
I play the former leader of a platoon of Marines, and we're all still in contact in our civilian lives, and I've taken on a job as a real estate agent, and I'm just getting started and trying to sell them on my new house and the developments around me, I guess.
I built a dynasty. I used the money from my old man's inheritance and got myself an official real estate license. I put each and every one of you in a place out here. I'm in, Roy.
Really, Chico?
Yeah. If it's okay with Sarge, then that's good enough for me. Follow you to the gates of hell, Sarge.
Oh, again?
That's right. Laughing all the way.
No offense, Sarge, but this here's in the middle of nowhere.
Sure, maybe now it is. But in 2 years' time, the state's going to put an interstate on the other side of this hill. The state assembly just lined up the funding. Nothing will stand in my way. No kidding?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so that's this guy who's going to make a bundle of money, and a few years later, he's going to get his twin kids to be part of his empire. And
his son, at least.
Stuff goes wrong.
Yeah,
what happened?
Things don't kind of go his way. I mean, I think for me as an actor, it's kind of a story of someone who's kind of grappling at any kind of control he can get in his life, and the more he kind of misses that hook, the more frustrated and kind of just crazy it makes him. Things don't go his way. His kids don't exactly turn out the way he wanted. But
one of them is gay.
Yeah, I think he.
And one of them is Bertie Bob Watt.
Yeah. Yes, the wonderful Bertie Bob Watt and Owen Asdell play my children, and Noah Hayden plays my wife. And what a great opportunity is to work with him. But yeah, it's a great story about someone who's kind of pathetic but doesn't really see it because he just can't. Well, he's so unself-aware. It's kind of sad too, but We can go along very deep into that, I suppose.
Yeah, so in one, without giving it away in any great detail, I think it is fair to, you know, I can say that he ends up being more and more, you find out more and more what an SOB he is and how screwed up he is. And
yes.
I got the idea that maybe I was interpreted this wrong, that he was trying to sell these tract homes on top of a toxic waste dump or something. Oh, yeah, so the people are getting sick in the neighborhood, like the old man who's next door.
Yes.
And so it gets a little bloody, as we said earlier. So if you're not done with Halloween, you can have some of that there. And I won't tell what exactly happens, but it's kind of fun and shocking and disturbing.
Absolutely. During the course of the 16 years that we've been doing Shocktoberfest, I think we've seen entertainment change so much in America. We have to look more deeply at, what is shock value these days? And, of course, you head then towards some of the most intense taboos, mm-hmm. like boy puppies, that one can think of. And cannibalism. Cannibalism is also prominently featured in the show.
Oh, that's right. We have the dinner of the daughter, Donner
down
party.
At the Donner party diner.
Down at the Donner party diner. A little song, a little vignette. How sweet. And the miners before that.
And I think we get desensitized to violence on the screen as well. And there's something about seeing it right in front of you with the arguably magic tricks of blood special effects working perfectly in front of you. It's a great chance to suspend your disbelief towards violence in a way that television doesn't necessarily ask you to do because it's so real looking on television.
So now that we live in a society that seems to have a lot more violence, has Grand Guignol, has it had to become a little more up the gore factor or the violence factor, the shock factor to get people to be shocked? I mean, in other words, if we saw something 40 or, 1920, would it seem like tame by today's standards?
Well, they had some very bizarre deaths at the Grand Guignol, being mauled by a puma, sliced to death by an invisible dagger, some really strange things. So they definitely had great imagination as far as death goes. We do find ourselves, I think, dealing with death with more frequency in a one-act play with Shocktoberfest than the Grand Guignol did. Rather than leading up to one event, in some cases there are 3, 4, 5 violent set pieces, if you will, throughout the course of the one act.
And talking about upping the ante or whatever, if you will, on the shock value, you've got to give just props to the author, the writer of the play, Rob Keefe. I mean, he really came up with some really interesting, shocking things when we read it out loud, it was just like we were all wondering how we were going to even make it happen. And, so he's really done a great job of finding creative ways that actually don't seem out of context as well. It's really well written, but scary.
You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. My guests are David Bica, an actor and singer in Shocktoberfest 16, Curse of the Cobra, and Russell Blackwood, the director and founder of Thrill Peddlers Theater. I want to leave some time for Club Inferno. When we spoke on the phone earlier, Russell, I think you said it's your favorite or among your favorite Thrill Peddlers shows ever. Why is that?
It really is. It's first of all, it's a glam rock musical inspired by Dante's Inferno. So a glam rock trip to hell, can't beat it. It's also the next generation, I would say, of the Cockettes in San Francisco. The Cockettes were a group that was founded in 1969 that produced shows like Pearls Over Shanghai, Tinsel Tarts in a Hot Coma, and Hot Greeks. These pieces that Wiss Grumbly, who was an original member of the troupe, we've been reviving for the past 6-7 years.
Yeah, to much acclaim, I must add. Yeah,
well, thank you.
Very fun productions.
Club Inferno is that next generation of people. So this was a rock musical that was first produced at the Paradise Lounge at 11th and Folsom, which is now being turned into a Mexican restaurant. And it is really a trip through the 9 levels where Dante, who in this iteration is a pop singer, a female pop singer, I would say, visits the 9 levels of hell with Virgil, the epic poet, and on each level meets a different person who, for whatever reason, fame had been their undoing, or fame has somehow narrowed the world's memory of who they are. So Karen Carpenter and Mama Cass on one level are lovers in hell together, uh-huh. and talking about how their two eating disorders complement each other, and that they'd finally found each other, and it took being in hell to find that.
Uh-huh.
Lucretia Borgia sets out to kill Dante at the Inferno day spa that she now runs on her level of hell. Lots of different styles of music in it, but very exciting to have a 45-seat theater and 8 live musicians on stage, yeah. plus the rest of the cast.
Well, let's play a little bit of it right now. This is part of Little White Lies from Club Inferno. And who's being portrayed here?
I play Amy Semple McPherson, who probably is the least famous of the famous people in the show, and we riff on that a little bit in the show. But she was kind of the first televangelist before television. She was a very famous. She founded her own church, and she was a radio personality, basically your snake oil salesman of today, but, you know, before video. And she came to a demise. She became addicted to pills and eventually died of kidney failure and everything. But
perfect. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Once I was lost, but I found my way. My darkest night turned to my lucky day. A spiritual hole looking to be filled. I was lost in a carnival of Jezebel thrills. What was I doing in the dark of the night? I saw the light and it set me free. Calling to the Lord led to my ecstasy. Everybody came laying hands on me. Loving my fellow man was my ministry. There's a party in my pants, free love to believe. Little white lies come and set you free.
That's David Bica singing Little White Lies from Club Inferno, and that's coming back in February, right?
It is indeed. First Thursday of February, we'll reopen and run just 5 weekends with a special Valentine's show.
Oh, that sounds good. So let's get your tickets for that way ahead of time. And I forgot to say earlier where folks can get info and tickets if they want to go see Shocktoberfest 16, Curse of the Cobra, which is running now through the 21st of November. All that information is available where?
Well, they can go to hypnodrome.org, hypnodrome.org. We also have Grand Guignol research website, and that's at grandguignol.com.
And there's also thrillpeddlers.com, which
there
might even
indeed.
Be easier to remember. Thrillpeddlers.com, where you have both of those, so many websites.
Look us up on Facebook.
Yeah, oh my God, it's overwhelming, really. So Google whatever you do out there to find out where things are happening just a minute beforehand. So,
and the Hypnodrome's at 575 10th Street, just south of Bryant. So
right,
in the South
under
of Market
kind of like the division under that like old freeway, Central Freeway thing. Quick question to ask if there's another Cockettes revival coming up anytime soon.
Not one that we have planned, that we're continuing to work with Scrumbly, and I can't rule out that there wouldn't be another Cockettes revival on down the line.
Okay. I want to thank you both very much for being here. We're going to start rolling in the background here. That song that you mentioned that was Mama Cass and Karen Carpenter.
Yes, My Other Half.
My Other Half, which is in the Club Inferno show. So thanks to Russell Blackwood and David Bica of the Thrill Peddlers for being here to tell us about your Vine Troupe and Shocktoberfest 16, playing through November 21st. Thanks also to John Fisher of Theater Rhinoceros, who was in here the first half of our show. His new play, Shakespeare Goes to War, is now at the Thick House, info@therhino.org. Out of the Bay is independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. We thank KALW for helping the show grow over the past 11 years and for studio use and tonight's engineer, Debbie Kennedy. On our website, outinthebay.org, you can hear free podcasts and download Stitcher to hear our show and other radio programs on your cell phone and other devices, outinthebay.org. Thanks to Debbie Kennedy. I thanked her already. Thanks again, Debbie. Thank you all for your past support. Thanks for listening. I'm Eric Jansen. We are out of time. My Other Half continues from Club Inferno.
I'm your dessert,
your casserole.
I'm Duncan Hines.